Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, you can press star one to ask a question. I'd also like to inform parties that the call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the call over to Mr. Sean Wilson. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Sean Wilson. I'm one of the organizers for today's call. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services Division of Mental Health. The title of today's webcast is Williams versus Quinn Consent Decree, Draft Implementation Plan. You will hear from a panel of speakers today, and those speakers will announce themselves as they present this morning. But before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few helpful tools and housekeeping items for the online portion of the forum. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed. That number is 888-455-3073. Again, 888-455-3073. And as always, our passcode is Illinois. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only. But if you would like to log in to see the webinar presentation and PowerPoint this morning, the login information is located on the invite you received after you pre-registered. If you are experiencing any problems with that particular link to join, you can also go to www.joinwebinar.com. Again, that's www.joinwebinar.com and enter the web ID directly on that page. The webinar ID is 837-060-443. Again, the webinar ID is 837-060-443. There will be a designated question and answer portion toward the end of today's presentation. We ask attendees to hold your questions until this designated question and answer period. The operator will open up the lines for you at that time. Lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take you less than 5 minutes to complete this survey, and we value your feedback. So without further ado, we will now begin the formal presentation. I would like to turn it over to our first speaker for this morning, the Division Director, Dr. Lori Rickman-Jones. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean, and good morning, everyone, and thank you for participating in our webinar on the Williams Implementation Plan. The Williams Consent Decree was negotiated over a two-year period and was finally signed in September of 2011. The court monitor was appointed shortly thereafter, Mr. Dennis Jones, in October of 2011. The consent decree required the state to develop a draft implementation plan that followed and was consistent with the elements of the consent decree. That plan was due on February 10th of 2011. The plan had to be comprehensive and specific in terms of approaches, strategies, and timelines for meeting the requirements of the consent decree. It was presented to the court monitor and the plaintiff's attorneys on February 10, 2011. Due to the limited amount of time that the state was afforded to put this plan on paper, we spent the last 4 months or so bringing state officials together and experts within the state to draft the elements of this draft plan. State agencies that participated in the drafting process included Healthcare Family Services, Department of Public Health, Illinois Housing Development Authority, the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, the Governor's Office, and our sister divisions in DHS, Division of Alcohol and Substance Abuse. Now we have the next 3.5 months to enhance and improve the plan by affording opportunities for broader stakeholder input. This is one method by which we hope to do that. So today we hope to educate a broader audience about the elements of the draft plan in an effort to get additional input to strengthen what we have already put together. Other methods for getting input into the plan will include focus forums, of which we are planning two over the next month and a half. So in total, we have two focus forums, two webinars. We're planning another one of these webinars in the near future. And we have the website is posting the plan, and there are sites which allow people to post their comments. The draft plan is organized around the functional elements of the implementation approach. So we will first hear about outreach and dissemination, path screening, transition coordination, housing, community-based service system, and our quality assurance plan. Presenters today are all state staff who will be implementing aspects of the plan as we move forward. So we will start with Brenda Hampton from the Division of Mental Health, who will talk about outreach and information dissemination, followed by Jean Summerfield from Healthcare Family Services, who will talk about the PATH and resident review assessment process, followed by Brenda Hampton, who will talk about the transition coordination process, followed by Sam Morka from the Illinois Housing Development Authority, who will talk about housing and residential options, followed by Leanne Reinert from DMH, who will talk about the community service system, and Britton Harris, who will talk about quality management. Britton is from DMH. Mary Smith will end with a small presentation on our IT systems that will be in place to support the implementation plan. So we look forward to your questions and answers at the end of this presentation. And again, thank you for attending this morning.
Good morning. This is Brenda Hampton. I am going to present the outreach and information dissemination section of the implementation plan. And in conceptualizing outreach, I wanted to frame it with a quote, and I just want to read this quote to you. Information is the source of learning, but unless it is organized, processed, and available to the right people in a format for decision making, it is a burden and not a benefit. We are doing a major philosophical shift in our application of change in compliance with the Williams Consent Decree. And we needed to base the foundation in ensuring that residents of IMDs have accurate information and plentiful information on their options of choice. And so with outreach and information dissemination, we want to make sure that residents have the ability to understand their rights under the consent decree and that they can make informed choices concerning their options and opportunities for community-based transition. We will do this by ensuring that each of the 45 Williams class members understand choice and understand what that means in relationship to their residency in one of the 25 IMD nursing facilities. We also want to make sure that we have a very firm operational process for providing information to class members and their families. And finally, we want to make sure that clearly residents understand what their objectives are under the Williams and what the goals are under the Williams Consent Decree. They can then become informed consumers. They can participate clearly in the transition planning and transition processes, and they can take ownership in terms of their next steps in their recovery. We also want to make sure that communication is transparent as well as fluid, and therefore we want to make sure that information is conveyed in a consumer voice to the consumers that is both consumer-friendly and consumer-sensitive. How will we accomplish this? We have proposed in the implementation plan to hire 9 recovery support specialists and 2 mental health professionals. These employees will be on contract with the state for a period of 2 years, and it will be these 11 employees that will go into each of the 25 IMDs and provide information on recovery as well as transition. Each of the 11 employees will undergo an extensive orientation and training. We want to make sure that they have very accurate information on community-based options. We want to make sure that they have very accurate information on resources. But more so, we want them to be grounded in the philosophy of recovery. So they will go through an extensive orientation and training on each of the elements of not only the Williams Consent Decree, but also our service delivery system so that they really understand the system of care. We will actively recruit staff who are bilingual, English and Spanish, and we will actively recruit one recovery support specialist who is bilingual in English and Polish. If there is a third primary language of residents in the 25 IMDs, we will look to recruit a bilingual recovery support specialist in that third language. However, we know that we do have multiple languages for residents, and we will retain interpreter services who will be available to translate for those who have limited English proficiency. Each of these outreach workers will be supervised by an associate director of long-term care assessment. This is one of the state employees that will be hired to help us implement the implementation plan. So we have been working collaboratively with HFS, Healthcare and Family Services, in order to identify the methods of operation. And how we will accomplish this is that HFS will provide what they call a provider notice to each of the 25 IMD nursing facilities with very specific specifications. The provider notice will ask each nursing facility to make sure that space is available for the outreach workers. Outreach workers will work with the nursing facilities around their schedules so that they won't be intrusive to programming that may be going on with the residents there. But we want to make sure that we have space to ensure confidentiality for both the residents and their family members if they want one-on-one dialogue. Each of the outreach workers will receive from the nursing facility two lists. One list will be by the name of a resident and the assigned floor, and the next list will be by the assigned floor and room with the name of residents. And that way we can do a cross-check to make sure that each of the 45 residents of IMDs have a contact with the recovery support specialist. But it's not just one contact. We want to make sure that that initial contact occurs, and then we want to make sure that there are ongoing opportunities to respond to any questions or needs that residents or family members may have. The outreach workers will have an introductory meeting with each resident, and in essence, they'll explain the will and settlement, explain the rights of options to choose community transition, and explain basically what those options may be. The residents will be asked to sign a letter of introduction, and this letter of introduction will basically be our verification that outreach occurred. The outreach workers will stay in the facility for a period of 2 years, so residents and family members will have ample opportunity to re-engage with the outreach workers, to ask questions if they were not clear on a response, but there will be ongoing exchange for a period of 2 years. Other methods in order to assure that we are fulfilling not only our obligations to provide outreach, but we are doing so thoroughly, is to use brochures and flyers. We will develop brochures and flyers in English. We will also have them translated in Spanish and in Polish. And again, if there's a third language of majority, we will have translation done in that third language. Each of the outreach workers will have access to a laptop so that they can show a video presentation. We will procure a videographer who will go out and showcase consumers who are currently in recovery, consumers who are living in their own permanent supportive housing unit, consumers who have transitioned into supervisor supported residential settings, if that is their level of care need, but to see consumers in different aspects of recovery who are no longer residents of IMDs. And this is to give an opportunity to show to existing residents that there is life and that life is ongoing outside of the nursing facility. Outreach workers will also participate in community meetings within the nursing facilities on a monthly basis. We will distribute our consumer handbook, which I think is an excellent document to each resident, so that they will have this as a resource information. And then clearly, we will have the opportunity for one-on-one dialogue and discussions with outreach workers ongoing. As I indicated, all materials will be translated in Spanish and Polish, and another primary language if necessary. I'm going to defer the data collection here because Mary Smith will talk more about the IT contribution in our whole implementation plan, so we can go to the next slide. And this is just some general time frames in which we had indicated that we hope we will have staff on board. We want to make sure that we have all staff thoroughly trained so that implementation can begin, outreach can begin by August of 2011. So this just gives you some targets in which we want to meet in order to get our outreach workers on board. Now I will pass this over to Jean Summerfield from Healthcare and Family Services, and Jean will talk about the resident review component of the implementation plan.
Good morning. The consent decree requires the state to assess all nursing facility IMD residents who consent to an assessment regarding the possibility of transition to community alternatives. To undertake this process, we're going to use the resident review component of PASR. Those familiar with PASR screening or resident review will be acquainted with the very partial snapshot of information available and its limitations in finding the best options for people with longer-term and intensive needs. So we're going to be sort of redesigning the process to meet the purpose of the resident review process in general, and in particular the process required to do good transitions for people under the Williams Consent Decree. So the purpose of the resident review is to assemble the most comprehensive picture of class members' clinical and functional abilities, preferences, strengths, needs, and service patterns. This is a long-term care population, and we should be looking at what their service use and the outcomes of that have been over time so that we can develop a plan that meets needs over an extended period of time and not just make a decision at the moment. In the next slide, there's a slight error. We're going to assess individuals who give consent to the assessment. Transition consent is a later issue where individuals will have the ability to accept the plan and move or decide not to do it, but all individuals will be asked whether they want to be assessed. The purpose will recommend specific appropriate community-based services and support, and the kinds of individual skill development and training or required supports for transition. The goal is to result in a comprehensive plan that will promote not just movement from the institution, but an individual's engagement in recovery through the transition process and ultimately in successful community living. So it's not just a decision up or down on transition to the community. Recent increased federal expectations of PASR and input from federal technical assistant consultants on PASR have confirmed what we had thought, that our PASR process needs a reworking. And we are going to undertake that as part of the process of resident review development for Williams to make sure we do the best job of it. Part of these improvements are listed in the next slide. We're going to upgrade the staff qualifications to utilize licensed personnel, eliminate commingling of evaluation and direct service provision, and enhance clinical components of the evaluation process to make sure that we get the information needed to do a very effective, good supportive plan. We will be adding strength assessment, substance use assessment, and a cognitive screen. And in particular, we want to enhance access to other data resources such as the HFS data warehouse and DMH's data warehouse, because in the money follows a person process, we've discovered that some things are not apparent, which can be seen in history and will be critical for some to be addressed if someone is to be successful in the community, substance abuse being one of those particular things. We're also going to develop formal reports of the assessment outcomes and findings as a foundation for transition coordination. And this will be a component of PASAR that goes forward so that nursing facilities and transition coordination agencies and service providers will have a more comprehensive result from the PASAR process. In undertaking this, we will go into an intergovernmental agreement with the University of Chicago College of Nursing Center for Healthcare Innovation, who is working with us on MFP. We will also incorporate into that process national experts in areas such as dual diagnosis and some other things that where we think we want to strengthen our assessment process, and also plan to engage in the process the University Center on Psychiatric Disability that's run by Judith Cook. The College of Nursing will create a resident review assessment unit for Williams that will be composed of licensed psychologists, social workers, and nurses, because we're also focusing on a comprehensive assessment that includes people's medical conditions and physical disabilities so that those are also part of what we need to address. Day-to-day activities will be under supervision of the College of Nursing. UIC will report on the indicators and measures to the DMH Deputy Director of Long-Term Care Assessment. This staff will assess the potential for transition from nursing facility IMDs to community alternatives. They will make recommendations on specific community-based services, including the type and degree of housing-related supports or supervision that are required to support successful community living. They'll identify individual strengths, preferences, needs, and risks, and focus, I think, more on engaging people's strengths than we have done in the past. The IMD nurse facility will prepare a list of class members by room and floor and by name, and that's so that we can find them. They're fairly large facilities, and so the staff need to be able to locate the residents easily. And they will begin the initial assessments of staff members who give consent very early in the implementation process of the implementation plan. The resident review unit will collect information that includes the information listed on the slide, social demographic history, psychiatric history and hospitalizations, substance usage history, conduct a cognitive impairment screen, assess comorbid medical conditions, what treatment is required, and the consumer's ability to self-manage those conditions, undertake a strength-based assessment with the consumer, and complete the LOCUS. And we're going to begin to use the LOCUS and the method in which it's intended as kind of an overall summary of the more comprehensive assessment information. The recommended level of care and appropriate community-based service needs will be developed, and there will be completed an assessment of maladaptive behaviors to make sure that we've identified any risk issues that need to be addressed. The resident review outcomes will be forwarded to a clinical team, DHS and HFS. These will be independent licensed contractors that are psychiatrists, social workers, nurses, to make a final determination, in particularly if there's some question of clarity in the results of the resident review. IMD residents who do not transition will have at least an annual resident review or may request a resident review at any time. People who do not initially consent to review may consent at a later time and will have the assessment process conducted. Mental health PASAR will have initial orientation and annual training, and the areas that are listed on that slide will give you an idea of how community-focused and recovery-focused and state-of-the-art rehabilitation technique-focused we want these resident reviewers to be. Thank you.
Okay, it's Brenda Hampton again, and I'm going to talk about our plan for transition coordination. Transition coordination is probably the most vital task that will have to be accomplished to make sure that we are sensitive to not only the consumer's needs, their preferences, the community-based options, but also that we are doing the transition systematically. We're coordinating with vital resources in the community and making sure that there's guarantees that those resources will be in place, that we're synchronizing the timing so that all the vital components and parts align at the same time, and that we are actualizing the move both smartly and based upon the preference of the individual. So to accomplish transition coordination, we want to look and manage the appropriateness of the community-based options, including residential services, housing support, as well as support services, and to coordinate those effectively. We want to ensure that we have highly trained staff who are very grounded in principles of recovery and who are very familiar with community-based services and resources to assist residents in preparing for their readiness to transition and to best assist them in navigating each of the transition processes. Our ultimate goal is to make sure that transition is seamless and smooth and that we minimize any obstacles or barriers. To do such, we also want to make sure that transition coordination is effective. We also want to monitor not just pre-transition, but post-transition placement as well as housing options to make sure that we're maintaining the consumer's wellness and their stability, but also that they're maximizing their quality of life. To accomplish this, our proposal is to issue an RFP for a transition coordination entity. This entity will then hire bachelor's level staff who have experiences in mental health services, some aspects of mental health services, case management, community support, whatever, as well as master level supervisory staff who can also provide guidance and support to the the transition coordination unit. As I indicated, our intention is to RFP this out to an independent vendor. The vendor is not to be a direct contracted vendor of mental health services. However, the vendor can be a subsidiary or a separate not-for-profit corporation of an existing DMH contracted vendor. We want to make sure that we are not commingling service staff with transition coordination staff. And so because of this, we want to make sure we have separate governing boards, separate mission statements, and separate bylaws. The transition coordination staff, like all of the staff that will be hired or contracted to perform aspects of work for Williams, will have extensive orientation and training. It's very important that the TCU units understand the history of long-term care in Illinois, so they need to be grounded in the foundation of where they're starting, why we are at the point that we are now in terms of the Williams Consent Decree, the history of the Olmstead Act, as well as all of the governing rules that we fall under within the Division of Mental Health, particularly OIG Rule 50 and 51 on reporting abuse and neglect. Concurrently, the TCU staff will have extensive training, and because they will interface so much with the outcomes of the PASR process, particularly the resident review process and the clinical review team, they need to understand PAS. They need to understand resident review, the interface between the two. Understanding outcomes and strategic strategies of engagement. They will be working with individuals who may be very difficult, who will come to the table with a lot of complications, and how do they work through those processes? They need to understand comorbid medical conditions. And from our experiences with our Money Follows the Person demonstration, we understand better the impact of comorbid medical conditions as well as substance abuse on either the successes or the trials of individuals who have transitioned out of non-IMD settings at this point. We want them to understand strength-based planning. So they're looking at what is it that the consumer is interested in doing and planning around that, be it supported employment, be it volunteer work, be it academic pursuits, but making sure that they can build on where that consumer is and to maximize those strengths. Likewise, to help the consumer identify appropriate housing options. From the information that the transition coordinations will receive from the PASR resident review process, as well as the review from the clinical review team, they will work with the individuals in terms of what the most appropriate housing residential array would be for them. And so they need to understand what those resources are in the community, permanent supportive housing versus supervised and supported residential settings, and what supports are within proximity to those settings. Clearly, navigating benefits and entitlement, we have found that this has been a challenge with Money Follows the Person. If you don't coordinate the timing of transition of benefits entitlements from the nursing facility to the resident or their representative payee, that then brings another host of challenges that could have been avoided. And last but not least, in terms of the coordination aspect, is coordinating with a community mental health clinical home or mental health service provider. We want to make sure that the linkage is not just in place, but the coordination as well as the engagement is placed, again, to help maximize that individual success in the community. The transition coordination unit staff will be doing three key things in that transition process. They will be developing what we call a risk assessment and mitigation plan. These plans have been put into place with the Money Follows the Person demonstration, assessing what risk factors may be in place for that individual that may potentially be a barrier to their success in staying in the community. And the risk is not necessarily a behavior risk. It could be a healthcare issue. It could be a maintenance issue, but if it becomes a potential factor that may have a bad outcome for the individual, there needs to be a strategy in place in order to mitigate that. So each of the transition coordination units will put together a risk assessment and mitigation plan. Each of the transition coordination staff will develop with the consumer a transition plan. What are the things that need to be in place to make that transition a reality? Housing is the first thing, making sure that housing is in place. But this transition plan and service plan will really be the blueprint for the community vendor or the clinical home when that individual transitions into the community. And lastly, the transition coordination unit will be responsible for post-transition monitoring. So they are looking at the efficacy of that transition process. They're looking to make sure that the services are being provided to the consumer. They're looking to make sure that if there's any critical incidences, that those critical incidences are staffed with the community agency so that they could either be a learning experience, how to do things differently on behalf of that consumer, or to look at what needs to be changed with that consumer in order to make their stay in the community successful. So how will this be accomplished? Each of the IMD residents, as you heard Jean explain, will have a resident review, and that resident review will be then referred to the clinical review team. The clinical review team will then make the referral to the TCU, and they will be the team that really helps determine what level of care need that individual may have. The TCU then will have a face-to-face introductory meeting with each of the residents. And like with outreach, as well as the resident review inspection. The TCUs will give to the resident a letter of introduction, and that letter will, the resident will then sign that letter of introduction. This, again, is our verification that that face-to-face contact did occur. The TCUs will review the records from the nursing facilities. They will talk with family members. They will talk with the residents to really get a good sense of what their residents' preferences are, where they would like to live geographically, and where do they see themselves in their recovery down the road. The next step will be to make sure that that housing is secure. So for those residents who are appropriate for permanent supportive housing, the Transition Coordination Unit will submit the application and work that application through the process so that the Transition Coordination Unit staff and that consumer can start their housing search. The Transition Coordination staff will go with the resident. They will look for housing through a lot of different venues. IllinoisHousingSearch.org is the web-based housing locator site that has been established by IDA and its co-partners of DHS and the Department of Aging. They will use other mechanisms like Craigslist, local listings in nursing facilities, and word of mouth. Each of the residents transitioning into permanent supportive housing will transition into a bridge subsidy model if that is what the resident needs. There will be residents transitioning back home to their family, or their income may be such that they can find an apartment, affordable apartment within their income range. For those individuals who may need some assistance, then they will be assisted through the Permanent Supportive Housing Bridge Subsidy Model, and the Transition Coordination Unit will help facilitate access to that resource. For those individuals who may not yet quite be ready to transition from the nursing facility and the recommendation of past resident review and the resident clinical review team is that there are still things that they could work on while they're in the nursing facility, those items, those skill development items will be listed by the Transition Coordination Unit, and they will be given to the IMDs to start skill building. The Transition Coordination Unit will then monitor the IMD's progress in helping the consumer build those skills. And that will be reported back to DPH. DPH oversees the operations of the nursing facilities in terms of compliance, and so we want to make sure that that is coordinated with that department. As I indicated, the Transition Coordination Units will complete the risk assessment and the quality of life survey. For those individuals who are not transitioning into permanent supportive housing, but may be transitioning into a supervised or supported residential setting, the Transition Coordination staff will still help facilitate that process for them and help identify a supervised or supported residential setting within the geographic area of that consumer's choice, if such a setting exists, or they will help them search for another supervised or supported residential setting within the array of services or availability within the DMH services network. As indicated, transition coordination will stay in place for 1 year post-transition. They will monitor quality of life, residents' wellness in the community, as well as the community services compliance with the transition plan. The TCU unit is very critical in convening meetings on critical incidents. So all critical incident reports generated by the transition community clinical home or community mental health services will be staffed by the transition coordination unit. And again, collectively, they will come up with creative strategies to approach or resolve whatever the situation may be. We're not going to break here. We're going to continue to move forward. And our next section of the plan that we will talk about is housing, because housing is critical to an individual's stability. If they don't have somewhere to live, our transition efforts make no sense. So with me in presenting the housing section is Sam Morka from Illinois Housing Development Authority. And it is critical that when we look at residential housing or the array of options, housing options, that we look at that based upon what would be the best mix and fit for the individual. We recognize that all individuals will not go into permanent supportive housing. We know that as a reality. We know that there will be some individuals who will need greater support initially before they make that transition to more independent living. And because of that, we have collectively worked with IDA to look at an array of options in terms of the housing development network for individuals who may be living in their own apartment through resources developed by developers. But we are also looking internally in terms of what do we need to bring to our service delivery system to address the needs of those individuals who initially will not move into permanent supportive housing.
So this is Sam Wardka from Illinois Housing Development Authority. I'm going to talk briefly about the funding components that go into affordable housing. I'm going to begin by talking about the capital funding and then follow up with funding on operations. Capital funding, very specifically, to be clear, is funding that builds buildings. It's not funding that maintains buildings or hires staff for buildings. The first capital funding that I'd like to talk about is the low-income housing tax credit. This is a tax credit out of the U.S. Treasury that is allocated to the states. In Illinois, it is allocated to IDA. We receive a number of tax credits to issue based on the population of Illinois. And these tax credits allow developers to have minimal or no debt on their properties so that they can serve low-income populations. These properties need to be in compliance and serving low-income populations for at least 30 years. Under the legislation that created the low-income housing tax credit, states, specifically IDA in this case, have to create what's called a qualified allocation plan, which sets out how they want to use their tax credits and what populations they want to serve. Under IDA's qualified allocation plan, we have something called our targeting program. This encourages developers to set aside 10% of their units to persons at or below 30% of the area median income who also meet one of the following qualifications: are a person with disabilities, are homeless, or are at risk of homelessness. We view this program as something that is especially beneficial for the Williams population as it meets the 25% test of no more than 25% of class in any one building, and because of its low-income targeting and specifically being for persons with disabilities. In addition to this, Illinois Housing Development Authority, another capital source we have, is we were allocated $130 million under the state's Build Illinois Bond Fund, the capital budget. This $130 million, $30 million of it, the legislation calls out to be specifically for persons with disabilities and at-risk veterans. The other $100 million is a little more general in that it just needs to serve persons of low income. That being said, IDA has made an internal decision that a majority of the funding will go to serve persons with disabilities and specifically to address the state's long-term care reform needs, including the Williams settlement. Other capital funding that IDA has includes the Home Investment Partnership funding, which is a block grant from the federal level, and the state's Housing Trust Fund. These are both very flexible sources, and as they become available, we will consider their use in meeting long-term care reform needs. So the other side of funding for housing is once a building's built, even if IDA funds the whole building and there's no debt on it. Buildings are expensive to run. Typically what we see is persons coming out of institutional care are on SSI income, which is around $640 a month. What they can afford to pay in rent does not cover what it costs to operate a unit. So in addition to the capital funding, there has to be something else. There has to be something on the operation side that funds the operation or rental assistance to the person. Traditionally, what we see is either one of two things, either a project-based subsidy that covers the difference in operational costs from what the tenants can pay to what is needed to operate the building, or a tenant-based subsidy, the most famous being the Housing Choice Voucher under the Section 8 program. IDA does have a small amount of funding for operating assistance. It's very small. What we are seeing for this class is that DMH has stepped up with their bridge rental subsidy that is similar to the Housing Choice Voucher, and I'll turn it back over to Brenda to speak about that.
Right. As indicated, for those individuals who will move into a permanent supportive housing, which is their own unit, their own apartment, and who are 30% or below area median income, we will overlay our bridge subsidy initiative to their transition. I want to underscore that bridge subsidy is not an entitlement. It is to be a bridge to another rental voucher, but we recognize that the majority of individuals transitioning out of IMD will not be able to find an apartment that is affordable within their income without some assistance. Each of the bridge subsidy units must fall within HUD's fair market rent criteria. For the metropolitan Chicago area, for example, that unit or one-bedroom apartment can cost no more than $840 a month. To assist individuals in their transition, we will also include a transition fund for them, and I'll talk about transition fund in a second. But our permanent supportive housing model, as you can see, is typically one-bedroom rental apartment. Self-contained kitchen and bathroom and living quarters are within privacy, so the individual has sole access to the unit. It can be, we can go up to a three-bedroom, three-person shared apartment. We know that individuals do thrive better with company, with somebody around them, that loneliness seems to be one of the major barriers in individuals transitioning from nursing facilities. So we will allow individuals to have roommates, up to three individuals in a three-bedroom apartment. Each of the permanent supportive housing units will have an inspection that falls under HUD standards to make sure that that unit meets qualification. We are looking initially, based upon the implementation plan, to satisfy a target of 256 units in the first year, a total of 640 permanent supportive housing units by the year of the end of year two of the implementation plan. And so therefore we're looking at available rental market stock, units in an apartment within existing buildings. We also understand that there's different models of permanent supportive housing that can be developed, and we were in a meeting just recently with a bunch of developers to talk about their partnership in developing site-based models and project-based models, as well as enhanced property management models, where services may be available on the premises, but the services still would be elective, and consumers will still hold a lease to their unit. But we have to look very creatively in order to develop or create an array of housing to meet the various needs of individuals transitioning from long-term care. And again, everybody will not be able initially just to live in the community in their own apartment without some support services on the premises. Another creative strategy in permanent supportive housing is called master leasing, and Sam will describe master leasing.
Master leasing is a strategy by which an organization can rent a block of units from one landlord and then re-rent or sublease these units to their population. It's something that we're looking at different ways of doing it, different ways of financing it. Another flavor of this is actually buying units in condo developments instead of master leasing, actually buying units in condo developments and then having the organization that buys them rent them out to the Williams class members. So there's a variety of methods by which we can obtain units quickly. And I think what Brenda alluded to in terms of finding the units for that initial 640 persons in the first 2 years is critical, because even if IDA were to fund developments today, once they go through the entitlement process of zoning and actually go through construction, it can be 18 months to 2 years before those units are actually on the ground. So it's critical that we find units that exist and we use creative strategies to acquire them.
For each individual transitioning, if they go into a there will be a transition fund attached to that individual that will be managed by the transition coordination unit or their clinical home community mental health center. And for those individuals transitioning into permanent supportive housing with a bridge subsidy, they will receive $2,000 to be applied towards their down payment, utility costs, and the rest of the money will be used to help that individual set up their household, purchasing household needs based upon a list of allowable expenses. And those dollars will be reconciled with the subsidy administrative entity. For those individuals who are transitioning into subsidized units, these may be apartments already with the operational bridge subsidy built in, they will receive $1,000 in transition costs, and again, that is to help them pay for any household needs. Individuals transitioning into supervised or supported residential settings will receive $250 in transitional funds, and that's to help them get any kind of anything that they need in order to do self-maintenance. So they may have hygiene needs. They may need to buy a coat. They may need to buy underwear or anything to help them in that move out of the nursing facility. So that makes me, that allows me to segue into supervised and supported residential settings. And as you hear the change in language, I am no longer talking about housing, but I am talking about residential treatment settings. And we are turning the battleship on our residential services. They are no longer or will no longer be settings where people stay indefinitely, but they will be settings where there are goals to transition to the next level of independence. And so our supervised residential setting will be time limited up to 24 months. Individuals must fall within certain locus score assessments, and they will be pre-authorized for these settings. Likewise, with our supported residential setting, individuals, the time limitation would be 18 months based upon medical necessity and re-evaluation, so an individual logically may end up staying there longer if that medical necessity assessment determines that they need a longer length of stay. And their locus score assessment will fall in a range of 15 to 25. We're looking at other housing models. For example, a fair weather lodge model might be another model that Illinois will move to develop, which combines residential and vocational support. Another model that we may move to develop is what we're calling a pathways, and that's just our title for it. But it would look very similar to a supervised setting. Individuals would have rights of occupancy either on-site or off-site, services either on-site or off-site. Individuals would have their own apartment, or they may be group settings, but we might be able to use these also as diversion or step down, particularly for individuals transitioning from hospital settings and we're trying to avoid an admission into a nursing facility. Individuals accessing housing will be handled two ways if they're going into permanent support. Well, either way, either permanent supportive housing or a residential setting, there will be the clinical assessment. There'll be a level of care determination on need. For individuals going into their own apartments who qualify for permanent supportive housing, they'll go down that pathway of working with a transition coordinator on the housing search. Individuals going into supervised or supported residential settings will work with the transition coordinator in accessing that appropriate setting based upon geographic preferences. Oh, sorry, that's me. Sorry. We want to make sure that we are working with our co-partners, and Ida has been at the table with us through each step of planning on our housing array. We have in place a subsidy administrator or subsidy administrator entities, which are, for the most part, housing authorities. They will, their role will be to make sure that rent is paid timely, to make sure the housing inspection is done annually, initially and then annually, and as needed, particularly if there's complaints, to do income verification to make sure that an individual's income is still within 30% or below area median income, and to make sure that there is a contract completed with the leasor that will establish the terms of our contractual relation as a permanent supportive housing model.
So one of the ways that we're going to make sure that we have housing stock and look for it is we do monitor the number of units available on the statewide housing locator, ilhousingsearch.org, and we have information through that what features those units have, including rent levels, whether or not they're familiar with the Section 8 process, what disability features they may have, including roll-in showers, et cetera. So if we are getting reports from the transition coordination unit that they're not able to find units, we're able to back monitor what is actually available in the market.
So this concludes our section on residential housing options. And now I want to turn it over to Leanne Reinhart, who will talk about our community service section.
Thanks, Brenda. Good morning, everyone. In order to be compliant with the terms of the consent decree, we have to assure that all of the members have access to all services and supports that are needed, and that those are readily available to each of the members as they move out into the community. At a minimum, the consent decree requires that the state provide any required mental health services funded through Medicaid, or as you may more commonly hear them referred to, Rule 132 services, as well as additional Medicaid state plan services that are available to individuals that are in addition to the traditional mental health services. So Medicaid state plan services for other health care needs, for substance abuse needs, those types of things are the other state plan services that we're referring to. But in addition to those minimum services that the consent decree requires, the division, as I'm sure you're aware, embraces a vision of recovery. And in order to support individuals in obtaining their recovery goals, the current state of knowledge that's most recognized and accepted within the mental health field is that in addition to those traditional types of Medicaid services, individuals need additional services and supports that are beyond those that are federally authorized to be billed to Medicaid. And we know that in supporting individuals to meet their recovery goals, that there is also a long-term economic value because individuals move through their recovery and need less intensive services and supports over time and become more active members within the community. So in order to embrace this larger service need, what we are planning is a clinical home model. And this clinical home model will be based on something you may have heard of referred to as a medical home model. And the purpose is to efficiently and effectively coordinate all of the needed health services of an individual. There are both economic and clinical advantages to a clinical home approach. As you coordinate care, you reduce redundancies so that there's the economic advantage. And also, as you coordinate care, you see better outcomes, which is the clinical advantage. We know that individuals who have mental illnesses experience an even broader and at times more complex need for coordination of services because they require services at many times from a broader range of providers. And so we need to have a way to coordinate all of those various needs and all of those various providers that can be confusing for someone trying to navigate that system. So when we look at our clinical home, we're talking about the coordination of the mental health services available within our provider network and perhaps the expansion of that network, as well as other healthcare resources such as primary care health. We know that many individuals will have substance abuse issues, and so we need to make sure that those resources are coordinated and available. Many individuals have an interest in furthering their education and or returning to work, and so we need to coordinate those. We've just heard quite a bit about the housing resources, and of course that's going to take some coordination, and a variety of other issues that individuals may require assistance in coordinating other public resources as well. So what we are proposing to do is a two-phased approach because we don't currently have these clinical homes developed. So what we would be looking at for phase one is going through the end of the next fiscal year to June 30th, 2012. And during that time, there would be a variety of things going on, screening of individuals, assessment of our current resources, and beginning to provide those existing community supports and services to class members while enhancing the vision of recovery within the system and supporting the system in developing a more comprehensive way of providing care for these individuals. And planning for more efficient and cost-effective systems of care within the state. Then we would move into phase two, which would begin in July 2012 forward for the remainder of the implementation of this settlement. And during this time, we would see our clinical home model begin to be implemented. And, of course, we would continue to evaluate that so that we can continue to enhance the clinical home model and make improvements and monitor the cost effectiveness of this model once it is implemented. So I want to go through phase one in a little bit more detail. One of the first things that we'll be doing in phase one is a network sufficiency analysis. And we'll be looking at three things there. We're going to be looking at the quantity of services that are presently available within our provider network in mental health, as well as the services that are available for the other needs that an individual might have. Then we also want to look at the quantity of services that we could make rapidly available if we were to expand services from experienced staff and current providers. And finally, we want to look at the services that could become available over a longer period of time if we were to recruit and train additional staff either at existing or new providers. So one example of this might be the team services that we currently have available, assertive community treatment, community support team. We'd be looking at the capacity of our current teams. That's the first thing. Then we might be looking at current providers who have those teams that might be able to increase their capacity. That'd be the second point. And then the third one would be to look at providers who maybe are not currently providing team services but might be capable of doing that and what it would take to develop those services at additional providers. So that's just one example of what we'll be looking for as we do the network sufficiency analysis. Also in phase one, what we will be doing is some initial community placements of class members. So we're going to prioritize placement in these early months with individuals whose community service needs can most readily be met by what we know exists already. So the existing Rule 132 and other state plan services and the provider network that's currently in place. And then as we are able to do more work and develop additional resources, we will be moving towards placement of class members who are less likely to meet that criteria, meaning that they may have more complex treatment needs and need that broader array of services that we are working on developing. And by having this phased approach and by looking first at those individuals that we believe are going to be most likely to have their needs met by the services that currently exist, this is going to give us time to complete our network sufficiency analysis and to develop and implement those additional needed services within our community. Also in phase one, as Brenda has already talked about, the community transition coordinators will be begin their work with these individuals. And they are going to be responsible for, first of all, identifying what the service needs are of the individuals, and then assuring that effective referral is completed for that individual so that they are linked with all of the necessary services within the community. One of the things that we will be doing to assist these transition coordinators is we will be preparing some training and tools for those individuals. And the training will include training on guiding principles of recovery. And then we will also be developing tools. We'll be developing an online community service directory as well as an online resource and referral guide, which will direct the transition coordinators to the referral and enrollment processes for whatever services an individual may need. Can you advance the slides, please? Finally, in phase one, we expect to have the clinical home model. We will be initiating that by July of 2011. And one of the things that we expect to have completed, I need the slide advanced again, please, will be to convene a meeting of stakeholders for input and advice. Again, that will happen by July 2011. And then we intend to have our standards developed and whatever procurement process is necessary to be completed by July 2012. So that in July 2012, we will be able to actually implement the clinical home model and begin the service. For phase two, we will continue to do network sufficiency analysis and develop any additionally identified needed services. The clinical home model will assume responsibility for coordination of all services. And this will free up our community transition support to shift their role from that coordination to other vital roles and responsibilities within the consent decree for monitoring and reporting. And finally, we know that despite our best efforts at planning and anticipating needs, that there could be problems with access for a specific individual or for a specific service. And so we will be developing mechanisms that would address any problems with that access. And we will have a variety of individuals involved in that. Our DHS, DMH regional staff will be the frontline staff for any problem resolution. In addition, we will be identifying responsible staff from all of our sister agencies and other state departments, such as DASA, Developmental Disabilities, Department on Aging, HFS, who will then be available to assist us in very quickly identifying resources when those are necessary for an individual who's not been able to access a specific service. Then, of course, the Associate Deputy of Transition Coordination will oversee that. And finally, the DHS-DMH System Rebalancing Deputy Director will oversee that entire process. So that concludes the information about community services. So at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Britton Harris, who is also with DMH, who will talk about quality.
Thank you, Leanne. Good morning. I'd like to begin by stating that the intent of the quality section is very simply to ensure that everything is working the way it's supposed to work and that class members are getting what they need. The goal was to put together a comprehensive, continuous, and multifaceted plan. And we have three primary components of that plan. There is the compliance plan, the quality assurance and risk management component, and the continuous quality improvement component. So let me begin with the compliance plan. The primary objective is to ensure compliance with specific elements of the consent decree. The plan evaluates that structures and processes are in place to ensure compliance and aggregates and analyzes indicators that are specifically named in the consent decree and that we must measure to ensure that we are meeting those requirements. One sample indicator is that we will need to track is the number of class members that are offered placement in a community-based setting at the end of the first year. And the consent decree requires that we meet the goal of 256. There are two main staff that will manage the compliance plan. This will be the data analyst who will compile data and the compliance officer who will analyze this data and adjust processes to ensure compliance with the consent decree. The quality assurance and risk management component is organized around the flow of class members through the five key functional areas that you have heard today already. That is outreach, pre-admission screening, transition coordination, housing development, and finally community-based services. For each area, we have identified sentinel indicators, measures, and actions. The primary goals of risk management is to prevent risk through quality structures and processes, but also to identify and remediate risks immediately if they are identified. To ensure that we can manage risk, we created sentinel indicators. And these sentinel indicators are factors that pose a significant risk to either class members or the system. And one example of a risk to a class member is that we have to ensure that we are monitoring critical incidents that would affect housing, such as eviction. And one example of a risk to the system is that we have to track that we are meeting targeted development of permanent supported housing units. We've classified the sentinel indicators into levels, depending on the level of risk that they represent. The first level is barriers. This would be an issue that prevents further movement in the transition process, for example, delays in placement in identified housing. Second level is disruption. This would be any event that interrupts the established community placement of a class member, for example, a move to another housing setting. And the most serious level of sentinel indicators would be critical incidents. This would be an event that threatens the established community placement of a community member, such as eviction. So one example of these of a sentinel indicator in the area of outreach is ensuring access to class members in IMDs. It's the critical step in outreach. For it to be effective as a process, outreach workers must have access to class members in the IMDs. So we will be tracking the number of class members seen and any problems found with access, such as lack of cooperation by IMD staff. A key component of quality assurance will be monitoring. We will be monitoring services through certification reviews and post-payment reviews. These are processes that are already in place. In addition, we will be monitoring service plans. This will be performed by the Transition Coordination Unit and the DMH Quality Bureau. We will also be monitoring residential settings. There is a residential rule in development right now. This will include initial and recertification determination, standards for staff, safety, size, and maintenance. And finally, there will be permanent supported housing unit quality and monitoring. We have established minimum standards that all housing units must initially meet, and annual inspection of housing units, and response to failure to meet standards. These are the HUD housing quality standards that Brenda was discussing earlier. To inform quality assurance and risk management, we are going to need lots of data. Data is going to be reported from the field. Indicators are going to be routinely aggregated, analyzed, and monitored by staff, and will all be reported to the Williams implementation team. This is an interdepartmental team that is responsible for direct oversight of the day-to-day implementation of the Williams consent decree, and this group meets weekly to review progress and issues, including the sentinel indicators I was just mentioning. And this group has already begun meeting and has been for several weeks now. The third component is the quality improvement process. So this will move us beyond compliance measures and sentinel indicators and into the development of continuous quality improvement processes and measurement of outcomes to demonstrate the achievement of results for class members. It will be grounded in principles of continuous quality improvement. It will be supported by a multi-layered committee and reporting structure. It will be data-driven and continuous and ongoing. There will be two main structures to support quality improvement. That is the DMH Quality Bureau, that will provide leadership, policy direction, will coordinate across the various entities, and will monitor in-process and outcome measures, grievances, complaints, and appeals. There will also be established a quality improvement committee composed of state staff and stakeholders. This committee will ensure stakeholder guidance and oversight of the quality improvement program for Williams. And the next slide is a visual representation of how the entities will relate to each other. And as you see, the Williams implementation team, who does the day-to-day management, is at the center. And finally, a major component of quality improvement is ensuring improved outcomes for class members. CMH already has a robust outcome measurement system, and some areas we would propose to measure include class member satisfaction with housing, class member satisfaction with services, participation in treatment planning, social connectedness, family connectedness, and work and school functioning. I'd next like to introduce Dr. Mary Smith, who will be discussing the IT portion of the plan.
Good morning. So, you've heard the description of all of the important tasks that have to be undertaken to implement the Williams Consent Decree. So, to do this, and to provide support, the state must have the capacity to collect, analyze, and interpret data for all class members across multiple service systems, treatment settings, and payers to support transition planning, residential placement, monitoring, outcome, and quality assurance and improvement activities. And so data collection really must begin with outreach to Williams class members and IMDs and follow them across each service delivery system that's touched after discharge. What you see on the screen is the system approach that we're taking. So basically, we are looking at the five areas that have been discussed today. Again, outreach, resident review, transition coordination, housing options, and then community services. The approach that we'll be undertaking is as follows. So the first step that we have to undertake is to do requirements or data gathering and then some planning around implementing IT components to support the decision-making that's required for the consent decree. So one of the things that we've been doing is convening meetings with subject matter experts for each of the areas. We will be then looking at the business requirements as extrapolated from the decree, which you know is posted on the website. We'll be meeting with key departments to also determine data requirements. Based on that information, we'll actually be able to design the systems that we need. And following that, you know, once you design the system or the interfaces, it's necessary to build them and test them. You'll deploy them. You have to train folks to submit the right data and make sure that the data is accurate and has integrity. And then there's ongoing maintenance of the system. The data right now is housed in a variety of places. So, as you know, as you can imagine, you know, from hearing the descriptions of the various components of the consent decree, there would be data that's needed from the IMDs. There will be data and information that's needed from the transition coordination units. There's information required in terms of community-based services as well as housing. And that data, again, sits in various places. There's information in the HFS data warehouse. The Department of Public Health has information. DASA has information. Providers who provide services have information. BMH also has information that we routinely collect. And then, as you know, there is a PATH mental health assessment process in place, and we currently collect data from there. So how are we going to bring this all together? We don't really envision one huge, all-encompassing information system because, again, data is required from different systems and different payers. Some systems need to be expanded because we are collecting right now. We think we're collecting a lot of the information and data that's needed. Some systems need to add new data elements. One of the driving forces for us is that what we don't want to do is duplicate data collection. And so to that end, we're basically looking at, again, assessing what the data requirements are, looking at the level of effort and the cost associated with enhancing some systems. And wherever possible, the plan is to really leverage our existing technology investments. Go to the next. So this slide shows some of the immediate next steps. Now, again, this is a draft implementation plan, so work has already begun. We have been meeting for the last month and a half with a multi-agency work group that includes members from the Division of Mental Health, from DHS Management Information Systems, Healthcare and Family Services, the Department of Public Health, and others. And the charge of the group has really been, again, to analyze the data requirements that are necessary to support the implementation of the consent decree. So we're about halfway through our work in this initial step. The first draft of a system plan is due at the end of this month. We'll present it to the court monitor. But that's just really a first step in implementing the IT pieces that are really required to support the implementation of the consent decree. One of the things that Brenda's asked me to share with you, there is a secure email address that you can send questions to if you have them about this presentation or about other aspects of the consent decree. The email address is www.dhs.williamsconsentdecree@illinois.gov. So we will post that for you. Right now, there's already a link on the DHS website. If you go to www.dhs.state.il.us, look over to the right side of the page under Features, you'll see a link to Williams versus Quinn. And so the secure email address, as well as this presentation and other documents that pertain to the consent decree, are posted.
Thanks.
Well, thank you. That concludes our formal presentation of the implementation plan. And Sean, we are finished with the PowerPoint at this point, and we'd now like to open it up for questions. I want to thank my team and my partners from other agencies who presented this morning, and look forward to your questions this morning and your feedback in general.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Jones. Sarah, if you would, please open the line to Q&A at this time.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to unmute your phone and record your name. To withdraw your request, you can press star 2. Once again, it is star 1 for questions. And our first question comes from Donna. Your line is open.
How do you undo this?
You're
open. Okay. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. It's actually Connie Tischhauser from Leiden Family Service. And I would like to ask a couple of questions to see if I could, if I'm understanding this correctly. The clinical home model, is that something embedded into the Williams implementation, or is that something that's for all consumers that, you know, are from, you know, get services from DMH? I'm a little confused about the clinical home model. Is that just for Williams?
It's actually probably best thought of as a direction that we would like to see the system go in, where providers are able to provide an array of services and or establish significant linkages for those services that they do not provide, looking more towards what is happening on a national level with requirements under the medical home model for strict collaboration and linkages or integration with primary health care. So we're going to hopefully make this a requirement for the Williams class members, but it's also a direction that we see the system moving in.
So that if we, you know, because we do consider ourselves to be the, you know, I mean, a clinical home for the people who are coming here with serious and persistent mental illness, But there's no type of procedure for that at this time then, where you become designated as someone's clinical home?
No, that's something that we're looking towards developing in the next year.
Okay, and then, all right, good. And then the next part is about the Williams case, because there was a draft residential rule, put out. And if that is connected into the Williams case, does that draft rule have to be in place? Or how does that fit?
I don't think that there's a draft residential rule that has been posted anywhere. We're in the process of writing a draft residential rule. And so there is a process that we're engaging in now that will ultimately go through the JCAR process. The residential rule is for the entire system.
Okay.
Obviously, it'll have some relevance to the class members, but it's for the entire system.
Okay. So if we currently have a supported residential program, and so that are we, if we wanted to serve some people that in the Williams case that wanted to move, then we would be contacted if a person chose this area? Is that how that would work?
Yes. Yes. An entity would be working with the consumer to determine not only their level of care needs, but what appropriate settings would be available for them, and then they would select.
Okay, and then if you didn't have, we have so many spots or apartments, because we rent apartments.
Yes.
And we have in the past done master leasing, and currently we have some more spread out apartments. So I was just wondering, are there going to be referrals into supported residential or in current supported and supervised residential?
We will have to work on the specific mechanisms and designs of how the referral processes will work. Over the next couple of months, there's a massive amount of work that will need to be done in terms of drilling down to specific details. But we will make referrals based upon consumer choice, ideally within those geographic areas where those resources are available. And so how that will occur is still to be designed.
Okay, and will there be, since the current system has, these programs have capacity grants, is that impacted in like if you took additional people, that those grants, those capacity grants would be increased, or is that not yet determined?
You know,
that's not yet determined.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Pat Burgess. Your line is open.
Well, actually, Pat Burgess is my mom, but this is Scott Burgess from Alexian Brothers, and I had a couple of quick questions. One was actually somewhat answered, I think, in what you were just saying, but I guess one of the things that I would encourage in the thought process around capacity grants, I know there's been discussion about per diem rates for various models of residential programming, and I guess
yes.
I would just encourage that you take a look at establishing per diem rates for these folks as well as for the system at large that would supplement what we're also able to garner in, you know, small amounts of Rule 132 services. So that's more, I guess, of a statement and just ask for you maybe to comment on that. And then the second question that I have is in relationship to on one of the pages here, it indicates that the class members are 4,500, and then it says estimated 3,200 will be appropriate or choose to move. Could you describe that further for me?
Sure. In response to the first part of your comment, I would encourage you to put that comment on the website or get that to us in writing some kind of way. We are looking at ways that we're going to fund these services going on. And, of course, a per diem is something that we would look at. We would also have to see how feasible that is, but we would encourage you to put that in writing and get it to us. The 4,500 is the size of the class. We presume that not everyone will choose to leave the IMD. We also presume that some people will not be appropriate for moving to the community because they have medical comorbidities that would make that level of care the most appropriate placement for them. So it's just an estimate of that is somewhat lower than the actual full size of the class member that we're working with. Is there a next question?
Yes, our next question comes from Jennifer. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Jennifer Humbert at Grand Prairie. The question was raised about the draft residential rule, and I had a question related to that also. You mentioned that the supported and supervised housing is being seen as time-limited. Is that just for Williams class members, or is that going to be across the board?
That will be across the board. Of course, if medical necessity requires a person to stay in that level of care, then they will be there. I think if you think of this as a system where the ultimate goal is independent living in permanent supportive housing, then we see people moving through levels of care until they can reach that option. So we would expect that people will get services, that services would help them gain independence, and so again, with the goal of achieving greater independence.
Mm-hmm.
If, however, they are not able to do that and medical necessity requires them to stay at that level of care for longer than the time limits that we have suggested for those levels of care, then that would be appropriate also.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Darla. Your line is open.
Hi. Question. Where do we apply for the capital grants, and when will they be available?
Sure. On the capital side, well, first of all, for the low-income housing tax credit, we have an annual round. This year's round, we accepted pre-applications, and then those who passed site and market suitability studies were invited to come back for a full application. So this year's round is already closed. So we will have a new round of tax credits next year. The Build Illinois Bond Fund, we have conditionally funded 6 demonstration programs, and we will have a general round or another demonstration round in the upcoming months. We don't have a set timeline on when that round will be. There's additional litigation in the state that may affect the funding source, but at this time the governor's office has told us that we are okay.
So will we be notified when the next round is open for bids on the contract, on the grants, or how will we be notified?
The Illinois Housing Development Authority does public notices when we have funding availability. You can always check our website, which is www.ihda.org.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Bob Hewitt. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is in regards to residential treatment settings. I was wondering how the time limits were determined.
Basically, we looked at what other systems were doing and what was reasonable to expect in terms of rehabilitation, attach those limits that way. It is a kind of a guideline for what we are hoping can happen in that period of time. If an individual's clinical status requires that they stay a longer period of time, then that is also an option. But it is an approach to move people through the system and to make sure that the services that they get are goal-directed and designed to help them achieve independence rather than have them stay there for extended periods of time.
Sure. One follow-up question. I was wondering when you mentioned other systems. Do you have any specificity about that?
I can get back to you, but we worked with our clinical experts out of Arizona who helped us design this, so I'd have to get back to you on that. But you can send me the send me a request for that information to my email, and I will respond to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Ron. Your line is open.
Hi. I have two questions. One, and obviously I'm from the IMD side of the providers. Because of the regulations around the psych facilities and the IMD, I'm wondering if these community-based services are going to be regulated, and if so, by whom and how?
That's a very good question. We actually just left a meeting prior to the webinar on this with Senator Steyn. The residential settings are currently monitored through our rule, our Medicaid rule, Rule 132. So we monitor the provision of services in residential settings currently. And Britton Harris can talk more about what we do currently with regard to the rule. We are in the process, however, of writing a writing a residential rule and a housing rule, which are geared more towards regulating those residential settings beyond just the service provision that occurs in those settings. So, Britton, you want to take a few minutes and talk about how we currently monitor?
Sure. Currently, any Rule 132 provider that provides 132 services in our residential settings has to be approved by DMH, and the site is inspected for life safety standards and fire safety standards in order for it to be certified. The certification happens once every 3 years and is a pretty robust and expansive process. In addition, as we were talking about earlier, we are drafting the residential rule that will get into more specifics and will specifically talk about staff, setting, and life safety standards.
Okay, my second question is regarding recidivism of using IMDs once people are moved in transition. We get a fair number of people that we help transition to community health providers and networks and the supportive housing projects that are out there already, and that pretty high level of these people either through our system of discharge planning or just come back, and when you're doing an assessment on them where they lived before, they lived in a group home, they lived in a supportive housing, they lived with their family. Is there going to be any process in this whole process that we're going to look at the success rates of the project and included in that how often people in the community are hospitalized for their psychiatric issues? Because part of this whole process is based on the theory that it's somehow going to save the state money. However, if people in the community are discharged to the hospital more often than people in psych facilities, then the cost savings is not going to be there.
Yeah, I think you raised some very good points, and we are going to be tracking these individuals and monitoring their outcomes. We are very concerned about the stability of individuals once they move out of the nursing homes, and that's one of the reasons why we've set up a transition coordination unit the way that we have done so. So they will actually be monitoring service delivery in the community for the first year. You know, one of the things that we want to make sure is that the individuals are in the level of care and having the intensity of services that are necessary to keep them stable in the community. We will constantly evaluate. These will become part of those sentinel indicators that Britton talked about. Anytime someone is hospitalized, anytime someone has to go back or wants to go back to an IMD, or anytime someone has an arrest or something like that, all those are major sentinel events that we will track and monitor, then go back retrospectively in the individual's history to see if we can do kind of like a root cause analysis to what led to that critical incident. So, yes, we're very interested in tracking these things. Our goal is to make sure that these individuals have positive outcomes, and so we will be tracking that information very carefully and making adjustments as we find are necessary to assure that we can reach that goal.
Great. And just a follow-up to that, will that information be shared in kind
Absolutely.
Of an aggregate level?
Absolutely. It'll be shared and posted, and it will probably, I don't remember what's required in the consent decree, but I know some level of reporting of this will be required in the consent decree, too. So,
okay.
Yes, it'll be very transparent.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Shirley. Your line is open.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to know, what is the distinct difference between money follows the person, permanent supportive housing, and the Williams consent decree?
Wow, those are three separate different things. I'm going to start with that, and I'll turn it over to Brenda. The Williams consent decree is the result of a class action suit that was filed against the state in 2000, I don't remember when, six, where there were four named plaintiffs who sued the state because of what their attorneys believed were a failure to develop community-based options that would allow them to have choice to move to the community as opposed to receive care in an institutional setting. So that became a class action suit. It was negotiated over a two-year period or more and ended up in a settlement agreement that was memorialized in the consent decree. So that's what the Williams consent decree is. It's regarding persons with serious mental illness in IMD nursing home setting. So that's that. Permanent supportive housing is rather a model of housing that represents the least restrictive environment that people can actually live in and receive services. So the permanent supportive housing model is predicated on the belief and principle and philosophy that people can live in very independent settings, apartments or houses just like we do, and that services can be wrapped around them, and that should be sufficient to meet their needs in most cases. So that is a model of housing that is nationally recognized and one that's highly promoted by advocacy groups for persons with mental illness. Money Follows the Person is a federal demonstration project that, again, is designed to help people move out of nursing home settings into the community with the concept that the money that the state and the federal government is paying for them in institutions can follow them to the community. Now I'll have Brenda say a little more about MSP.
Brenda, just before you say that, what my question really is pertaining to, how do we distinguish a mission of the class to these three different programs?
Well, number one, the class members are not eligible for MSP because they're coming out of IMDs and not nursing homes.
Okay.
So they're not going to be part of Money Follows the Person.
That's correct. IMDs are nursing homes, as Lori stated before, but IMDs are nursing homes with a claim status only. So IMDs are nursing facilities because they cannot bill Medicaid. They cannot be Medicaid reimbursed. Williams only applies to those 25 IMDs only. The majority are in Chicago, two in Lake County, two in Kankakee County, one in Peoria, and one in Decatur. That is the Williams class. Money Follows the Person is all the other nursing facilities right now only in Region 1, Chicook County. So that's the distinction between the two. Permanent supportive housing is a housing model, as Lori indicated, and we overlaid permanent supportive housing on both Williams and Money Follows the Person so we can transition the individuals out of the nursing facility. So it became a resource, the bridge subsidy became a resource in order to make housing affordable. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you, Brenda.
Our next question comes from Mark Furlong. Your line is open.
Hi, it's Mark Furlong from Thresholds, and I just wanted to know, I was happy to see that there's enhanced services mentioned in the community services section. And I wondered if you had any details on what those enhanced services might be and how they may be reimbursed.
Some of the enhanced services include things like supported employment,
a greater emphasis on peer-related services. Help me out, Leanne, since you did this.
Sure. We know that individuals that are coming out of the IMDs may need enhanced social supports. So we've talked about other development of other public resources and more natural supports for individuals for socialization and to meet a variety of needs that are outside of the current Medicaid services.
So
any sense of how those would be reimbursed?
Yeah, at this particular point, we would have to, those would not be Medicaid services, so they would be funded by the state general revenue fund.
Are there definitions of the services now?
Of the new services, you mean?
Right, the enhanced services.
No, this is part of what we will be working on in the next, in the coming months, as we do additional assessment of the individuals as well as the system and what the needs are, and as we learn as individuals start to be screened what those services are.
Some of those are well known, such as supported employment. You know, some of them are fairly well known, and drop-in centers, those kinds of things are fairly well known.
Okay, great. And I had one more question. Will the Rule 132 services be reimbursed at the existing 132 rates, or will there be an enhanced rate for Williams class members?
No, we don't anticipate an enhanced rate for Williams class members.
Or a per diem, possibly?
No, we don't anticipate an enhanced rate for Williams class members.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Donna. Your line is open.
Hello, this is Connie Tischhauser again. And the question I had was in regards to the time limits on those two types, on the residential treatment. And that predisposes then that if a person is not doesn't need medical necessity to remain at the, you know, 12th month, or say in a supported residential treatment, then that there would be a way for that person to have a rental subsidy in order to move, because that, you know, currently becomes an issue, or has been in the past, except now we have the bridge. So is that part of what we're talking about here, that those people who reach the level of being able to be independent in those two treatments, supervised and supported, would be able to have, you know, in a sense, get into the bridge program with a rental subsidy?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we are showing no further questions from the phone line.
Perfect. And then we're just about at the time that we should be ending this webinar. We want to thank everyone for your participation. Please feel free to send comments on the website. I appreciate your thoughtful questions, and this is a work in progress. We'll look forward to developing the final plan that is enhanced and enriched by your participation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. Again, this is Sean Wilson, and thanks to the general audience for joining us this morning. Sarah, if you would, please disconnect the main line now and push us through to post-conference. Thanks.
That does conclude today's call. Thank you all for participating. You may disconnect at this time.